Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Yaron Brook Show. This is Dom Watkins sitting in with Yaron Brook, who is out this week. But we're going to be talking about success today. What is it? How do you achieve it? Is it even possible to achieve it? And then later on, I'm going to update you with some of the events we have going on, many of them associated with the launch of Yaron's and my new book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. And today, in fact, we are at an event in Seattle that I'm going to tell you guys more about when I'll be joined by my colleague Keith Lockage. But that'll be towards the end of the show. Now I want to dive right in on this issue of success. There's a movie called Meet the Robinsons. It's a cartoon, and amazingly not too many people have seen it because it's just so good. But there's a villain who is described only as the bowler hat guy because he has one of those bowler hats. Google it if you don't know. And he goes in to pitch his invention, his evil invention, to a group of businessmen. And he says, the CEO asks him, he says, "So what do you hope to accomplish with this invention?" And the bowler hat guy says, "Oh, nothing of consequence, except to crush the dreams of a young orphan boy." Well, what if you wanted to crush the dreams of a poor orphan boy? What if your goal was to make sure that somebody was not successful, and you didn't want to use force, you didn't want to use government policy, you just wanted to get them to wreck their lives? How would you go about it? Well, one way to do it would be to invoke two of the main arguments made by inequality critics today. So if you're going to undertake this program to like take a bunch of people's money and give it to other people who didn't earn it, that seems a pretty high barrier if you're doing it that blatantly. Even in America today, with all of the altruism, with so much acceptance of the welfare state, if you're just openly saying to somebody, "Hey, you worked and I'm going to take what you created and give it to somebody else," that does not strike many people as fair, or at least it's suspicious. So what do you do if that's your agenda? And there's really two main arguments that come about here. And you can call them the luck argument and the sacrifice argument. So the luck argument starts by saying, "Hey, you can't claim that you earned that money. Nobody earns anything. Why? Well, because what we get in life is shaped not really by our choices, not by stuff in our control, but stuff outside our control. It's shaped by luck. And so nobody really earns anything. You didn't build that, so don't go around thinking you can keep it." All right. Well, then who should get what? If it's all a bunch of luck, how do we decide who's to receive and who's to give? And there you get the sacrifice argument. And that's pretty simple. Well, since nobody earns anything, what we should do is use it for the good of all. And what that really breaks down to is sacrifice the haves to the have-nots. If you've gotten something, remember, you didn't earn it, but if you got it, you owe it to others. You owe it to those who didn't earn anything, who failed for some reason or another. Now, set aside the political questions here, and even set aside where these arguments are going wrong. We talk about these in Equals Unfair quite a bit, but the thing I want to focus on is different. What if you took these arguments seriously? What if you actually said, "You know what, I believe the luck argument, I believe the sacrifice argument, and I'm gonna live by those creeds"? What's going to be the effect on your life? And I do think that we can see the effects of these ideas in the people who accept them, who in effect accept them. No, I don't think anybody sits around and reads John Rawls or, you know, some textbook and says, "Okay, that's how I'm going to live." But there's people who in effect live by these creeds. Well, I think it shows up in two related attitudes. So if you believe that everything was luck, What are you going to do with your life? What are you going to do with yourself? Are you going to work really hard? Are you going to go through the discomfort of trying to learn and grow, face rejection, face the fear and uncertainty of trying something new, trying something different? Not likely. I mean, what's the point? No, you're going to be passive. And I think a good word that captures this kind of idea is victimhood. I mean, people are genuine victims, but victimhood is different. It's the idea of nothing can be expected of me because I'm basically at the mercy of destructive and nefarious outside sources. What about sacrifice? What if you believe that it's the moral duty of the haves to sacrifice to the have-nots? Well, we usually think about this idea. We usually think about it from the perspective of the haves. And that's why people say, yeah, I'm happy to help out somebody who needs a helping hand. But you have to look at it from the other perspective. What kind of attitude is being inculcated in the so-called have-nots? So if somebody's going to live as a victim and not do anything, he's not going to achieve much. So what should his attitude be towards others? Well, according to the egalitarians, according to the people making the inequality argument, that's very clear. It is entitlement. It's not, hey, can you help me out? It's, hey, I'm in need. You owe me. I'm entitled. Now, does anybody actually think that living by these two ideas is going to lead to success, lead to happiness, lead to anything except for misery and, I mean, a really poor, bad society? Well, but that is not the goal of the inequality alarmists, or rather, that is the goal of the inequality alarmists. But their goal is not actually to lead people towards success. It's to discredit the successful and to demand the unearned for the unsuccessful, regardless of the reasons for their lack of success. Whether it's because of true misfortune, and we'll come to that, the role that genuine misfortune outside of your control plays in life, but also because of your chosen disasters. That is, if you play the victim, if you say, I can't do anything, I can't help it, it's all a matter of luck, so I'm going to play, I don't know, what are video games? I stopped playing video games when they still had Nintendo 64, so Xbox, right? So I'm going to sit around and play Xbox. That's really their kind of ideal. Now, the question I want to talk about today then is, what should we make of that? What should we think about that? Is success really just a matter of luck? Now, I do think there's reasons why people find this kind of argument plausible. I don't think it's completely ridiculous. I think there's reasons why anybody would be suspicious of it, and rightfully should be suspicious of it, the idea that success is outside of our control. But there are some things that make it plausible. So it's a good idea to start and say, okay, what's the best case for this idea of success outside of your control? Well, I mean, the basic fact is that outside factors, factors that you and I have no control over in our own lives, they can make things easier or harder. I mean, there's no question about that. For instance, anyone who has succeeded, anybody who's made something of their lives, we can always point to outside positives, right? I mean, take Bill Gates. So there was a book a few years back, and now I haven't read it, but I mean, this was something repeated quite a lot in what I did read, and so I assume it's true. Malcolm Gladwell has the book Outliers, in which he argues that, look, Bill Gates, he could not have succeeded without the luck of being born into a family where he happened to be surrounded by computers at a time when very, very few people did. And so, did it help Bill Gates become successful that this thing that he didn't have any control over? He was born to an affluent family in an area where they had computers before everybody else. Was that a factor outside of his control? Yeah, of course. Was it a factor that probably made his success possible, at least on a scale that it wouldn't have if he hadn't had access to these computers? I think very likely, yes. You can never run the tape back. But, I mean, we can grant that, right? Or take Warren Buffett. Now, Warren Buffett, a friend of Bill Gates, he's very interesting in that he makes the luck argument explicitly. He explicitly comes out and says, look, I'm not so great. If I hadn't been born in the 20th century, if I hadn't been born in America, if I hadn't happened to be born with a certain set of skills that are very useful in the world of investing, I would not be a billionaire. So, outside positives, things not in his control, and certainly did they contribute to his success? No question. I mean, if he had been born in Botswana, or if he had been born in, you know, Nigeria, or if he had been born in the year 1000, very unlikely he's going to be the wealthiest investor of all time. So again, outside things affecting his outcomes. On the other side, for anyone who hasn't succeeded, well, we can always point to outside negatives that made a difference. I remember in high school we read a book, In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, and I forget the details, but I definitely remember there was a big portion of the book that was committed to showing how the murderer had a really bad childhood and he was really mistreated and so on. And now this was meant by Capote to excuse his evil, but is it true that it's harder to grow up and form a good character if you have an awful childhood? If people mistreat you, if you're poor and deprived, if you know you're surrounded by examples of bad people? Yeah, it's definitely true that that makes it harder. And I mean, there's countless other examples like that. I mean, does it make it harder to become a millionaire if you grow up in poverty, you know, than if you grew up the son of an entrepreneur millionaire who sends you to really good schools and encourages you and teaches you? Yeah, absolutely. So there's all of these factors, and we could name countless others, all of these factors that are outside our control and that make a difference in how hard or easy it is to succeed. So what is the role of choice? If we're faced with all of these countless factors that we don't control, that we can't basically close our eyes and make a wish and change, if that makes a difference in where we end up, what is the role of choice? Is it a very meager one? Or is there something else? Now, to start with that question, I think we need to take a step back. We need to ask, what in the world is success? You know, it's one of those things that everybody says they want, everybody says is good. There's some people who don't, you know, I mean, there are the monks and the writers at Ceylon, but most people say that they want it. But nobody can quite agree on just what the heck we're talking about. So let's get clear on what we're talking about. Tim Ferriss, he's a podcaster, a writer. I listen to his podcast, and one of his standard questions, when you think of success, this is for his guests, when you think of success, who's the first person that comes to mind? And I mean, you get all sorts of answers, answers that are all over the map. Some that I recall, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Mother Teresa, Gandhi, Barack Obama. Often you'll get kind of family members or friends that a person's personally familiar with, and they'll be described as successful for all sorts of reasons, whether it's just a family that, you know, is really healthy and happy, whether they've, you know, made something of their lives in some small way. But I think what these illustrate is that this is really a contentious concept. I don't think that you can have a list with those various people and necessarily be talking about the same thing. I don't think there's any important respect in which Steve Jobs and Barack Obama are both successful. Now, both were famous, of course, but you know, if that's the standard of success, then no, not everybody can be successful. In fact, very few people can be successful, and in that case, it largely is a matter of luck, because I think you can do a lot of really good things, but to be thrust into the spotlight, I don't think that's necessarily something that is fundamentally in a person's control, particularly if we're talking about something like becoming president. You know, that's a one in several billion chance, and so if that's your aim, just so many factors are outside of your control. So we can talk about success in a delimited sense, right? We can talk about, look, you're successful if you achieve a given goal that you're out to achieve. And so, yeah, Barack Obama was successful in becoming president, and Steve Jobs was successful in making Apple a profitable company. And heck, Hitler was successful, at least temporarily, in invading different countries or becoming the dictator of Germany. But what we're talking about, obviously, here is something different than that. We're talking about a broader conception of a successful life, and in particular, of a successful career. That's the real question, is what is a successful career, And is that something that's open to your achievement? Is that something that you can choose to pursue and your choices will make a difference? Or are we all at the mercy of luck? So what is success in this sense? So I think a successful life, and certainly the perspective of Ayn Rand, the perspective of this show, is that a successful life is one in which you achieve happiness. Now, I hasten to add, happiness does not mean just a fleeting moment of pleasure. It's not what Ayn Rand called whim worship, just whatever you want, you got. We're talking about an enduring, rational, long-range happiness, a happiness achieved by achieving rational values. So whatever you want to say about Hitler's, quote, success in becoming dictator or conquering Europe, by this standard, he was an utter failure. An utter failure, somebody driven by fear, by hatred. I mean, the guy ended up committing suicide. So clearly, if we're talking about a successful life or a successful career, that's not the kind of thing we want to include. What we're really talking about is achieving a productive career that adds to or supports or contributes to a overall happy life. That's what we're looking for when we're talking about success. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to delve into, okay, what is such a career look like? What is a successful career, and how then can we achieve it? Are the egalitarians right? Is it something that we shouldn't bother to achieve? Is it something when people do achieve it, not worthy of respect because, hey, they just got lucky? Stay tuned, and we will find out after the break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
We're back on the Yaron Brook Show. This is Don Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. We are talking about success. And in particular, we're talking about this idea that we hear from the critics of inequality that, you know what, if you succeed, you didn't build that, you got lucky. And if you fail, not your fault, just bad luck. And so the only fair thing to do is equalize, try to remedy the bad luck in life by sacrificing the people who have received good luck. And so the question that we're on to now is, okay, what we mean by success is a career that contributes to a happy life. And so what are the elements of such a career? What is the standard for success in a career? What makes a career contributor to a happy life? Is it how much money you make? Is it how much power you have? How much fame? How much prestige? What do you think? I mean, certainly money is going to be relevant. And you know, if you're at a career and you're poor and broke and you can't do anything with your life, that seems to be a pretty unsuccessful place to be. But is a successful career one in which you make a ton of money? Is that the definition of success? Is anybody who makes a lot of money successful by the very fact that they make a lot of money? What about power, fame, prestige? Well, these, I think, are in a different category. I do think money is going to play a crucial role in success, although not as big a role as some people might think. But power, fame, or prestige, I think these are actually substitutes for what a productive career gives you. If you're focused on power, if you're focused on fame, if you're focused on prestige, that is not about getting joy out of a career. It's using a career, I think, in order to just fill something that's missing in yourself. I think it's the kind of thing that you do if you lack self-esteem. I mean, you know, really, who cares if you're, quote, famous? I mean, there's a lot of bad things associated with fame that I don't think people want. And so one simple way to see that if we're talking about successful in the context of a happy life, if this is really the essence of what a successful career was, money, power, fame, then we should be able to look around and see everybody who has money, power, fame is at least to that extent happy, satisfied, in love with their work. Well, I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, that's not what we see. Quite the contrary. I think it, in many ways, you're more likely to run into the opposite. There's so many examples you could give here. I'll just use the one that comes to mind first. I mean, the singer from Nirvana, Kurt Cobain. Here was a guy at the height of fame, the height of fortune, and was miserable in his career, said he didn't want to be famous, and eventually, bam, committed suicide. And, I mean, the examples could go on and on and on. The fact is that these are not central to a happy, satisfying career. It's certainly not the essence of what success is about. So what's it about? Well, I would say that there's three critical components where you can say, yes, that this person has achieved success in his career. And if you're missing any of these, I think that there's probably still work to be done. So the first is that you can be self-supporting, that the career is sustainable. There's a lot of things that people like to do in their free time, and usually if these things don't give you an income that you can live on, we call them hobbies. Now, you can, you know, find it, you know, your true passion in life might be one of your hobbies. It might be, look, I can't make enough money playing music to support myself And so that's really what, in effect, what fulfills the role of a career. And I think that's fine. But if we're talking about a successful career, it's going to be one in which you can make money. How much? Well, it's enough to support your overall goals in life. And that can differ for different people. I mean, let's say you're a musician and look, you are fine living in a shoebox-sized apartment, you know, driving a beat-up junker and living off of ramen noodles so long as you can play your music. Well, then you can perhaps make a self-sustaining career, a self-supporting career on, you know, not that much money at all, maybe a couple thousand a month. On the other hand, let's say you want a big family, you want to make sure your kids are able to get out of the government school system. You have real hobbies that you're passionate about. Maybe you're into, you know, mountain climbing and you love to travel the world to get to K2 or something like that. We can argue about whether it's, you know, climbing the Himalayas is rational. But nevertheless, what's required for you to be self-supporting is going to be very different. So money is certainly going to play a role. But is it a defining role? And I think there's two other elements that are really the central issue in terms of what a successful career is. I think first, it's work that you find mentally engaging, where you can really use all of your intellectual resources and experience that sense, constant growth. I think less than that, and it will not be a satisfying career. You wouldn't say somebody is successful if they're working 10 rungs below their capacity, below their capability. That's really what we're talking about. That's not success. That's stagnation. The other thing, though, is that the work should be meaningful. You're creating something you judge to be good or important or beautiful. Now, in the highest realms, I mean, somebody like Ayn Rand is writing novels that she thinks are fundamentally useful to meaningful to her and her life, and it's art, so it plays a crucial role in the lives of other people. Now, not every career needs to be focused on creating the most profound values. The example that always comes to mind for me is a carpet cleaner, right? I mean, here's somebody who's going to run a carpet cleaning business. Obviously, cleaning carpets is not the most essential role. Indeed, it's probably one of the first things you're going to cut out of your budget if you're trying to save up for something. Nevertheless, it's one of those things that people need and that makes their lives better. And it's something that a person should be really proud of doing. It's that, look, I can provide people with convenient, affordable carpet cleaning that leaves their house looking beautiful and more livable. It's helping make the world just that much better. And that's what I get my passion out of doing. I mean, you can take the contrast here to the importance of having some level of my work being good, important, meaningful. Take the contrast. This is kind of a tricky example, but the first thing that I think of is a defense lawyer who defends people he knows are guilty. Now, it's a legitimate career to be a defense attorney, but I think that you can really leave yourself susceptible to the experience of what I'm doing is not worthwhile. I'm not doing something good in the world. I'm perhaps helping get off people who need to be behind bars, destroyers of value, real thugs. And that's kind of an extreme example. But even take the inventor of the pet rock, right? I mean, he became a millionaire by selling these stupid little rocks with eyeballs. Now, you can argue there was a little bit of – it was really a – he was creating a humorous product. It had like a little guide on how to take care of your pet rock. But in general, you're not really doing something that is important or meaningful. And I was recently reading up on this guy, and he eventually just used the money to buy a bar that he hosted. But there was a quote that basically said to the effect, maybe my life would have been better off if I hadn't done that. And I think if you're going around trying to, create pet rocks that are really just aimed at parting suckers from their money, I don't think that that's what we would want to call successful. No, I mean, when I think of success, there's a lot of examples, but I mean, take one that almost everybody can see, and that's Steve Jobs at Apple. Now, obviously, he was self-supporting. I mean, he created an enormous, staggering amount of economic value that was able to more than meet his economic needs. He was also certainly and clearly able to use his mind at the highest levels. I mean, here was a guy who had to solve problems of management, of invention, of financing, of marketing, of projecting out the future of technology that was changing every day and creating a company that would last after he was gone. So, I mean, that's full mental engagement. And it's also clear that he loved Apple, that he loved creating great products. His whole mission, Apple's mission, as he put it, was we want to create products that we love to use. He saw that as something important. I mean, the objectivist phrase that comes to mind most when I think of Steve Jobs is this idea of reshaping the earth in the image of your values. And it's the idea of he thought things were not designed well. They weren't beautiful. They weren't built to give you that great sensual experience of using an amazing product, and so he wanted to improve that. And so I think not only did he have a successful career, I think he had a real conception of that. That's what a successful career is. And so, for instance, in his famous talk at Stanford during the graduation ceremony, it was one of his key points was you need to do what you love. Elsewhere, and I think we quote him in the book on this point. I think we even quoted him in Free Market Revolution on it. You know, he said that, look, I was a millionaire by the time I was, you know, in my 20s and later, you know, worth hundreds, you know, millions of dollars. And it was never that important because I didn't do it for the money. What was important to him, what he saw as success, was the fact that he could do work that really engaged him and that he thought was good and important. And I think that when it comes down to it, that's what success is. On whatever scale is open to us, Steve Jobs is a superlative achiever, but all of us can find work that is self-supporting, that is really uses our mental resources, and that we think in some form is good, that it's making the world that much better, that it's actually we're doing something that we regard as valuable. In what sense is that in a person's control? Getting that kind of career, in what sense is that something open to a person's choice? Well, I think it's helpful to ask the question, first of all, is there any reason to think that choice might be relevant in this whole issue? Just some common sense things that we observe when we look around. Is there anything that makes us think, yeah, you know, maybe it's not all luck. Maybe the choices that we make matter. Well, one thing I think obviously is our own experience. I think that everybody, or at least most people, have the experience that there's a connection between our choices and our results. And the people who don't see such a connection, I mean, these are the people really evading the connection between the choices that they make and the results they get. And whether it's career, whether it's our relationships, whether it's, you know, our weight, our health, we can see that, you know what, I've been eating a lot of cake and ice cream recently and I'm not fitting into my clothes. It's my choices are making a difference. But even in our own lives, whether it's students or in our career experience so far, we can see that if we had made very different choices, not showing up to work on time, not learning certain skills, that we would end up in a very different place. We can also look at the people we admire, the people that we definitely don't admire. And particularly when you look at the people you don't admire, I think it's very rare that a person's attitude is, well, he couldn't help it. No, we want to blame that jerk because we know he made his own bed. But, you know, read some biographies. Read the biographies of Steve Jobs or Olympic athletes or other great business heroes. Read the biography of Ayn Rand. Well, I guess a full-length biography of superlative quality is yet to be published. But, you know, it's the stories of these people. We can see, I think, in many ways, the connection between the kinds of choices that they're making and where they end up. So that's, I think that at least gives us a start, is that when we look at those things, when we look at ourselves, the people we know, people who are, you know, out there who we regard as successful or unsuccessful, we can see certain patterns that reflect very different choices. So what are some of those patterns? Obviously, we are not going to summarize the whole litany of what's required to succeed, but I at least want to make this a little concrete, right? We don't just want to say, hey, it's choice. What are the kinds of choices that are leading people to a fulfilling career, to a career that's self-supporting, that is engaging, and that is meaningful? Well, the first thing I think that comes to mind, and I mean, this is standard self-help stuff here, right? Like, you can open any book, and what's one of the constant themes you're going to get to? Goal setting. It's that successful people set goals. They have a purpose. They're actually aiming for something. It can be very broad or it can be specific, but they're constantly thinking of, what do I want long range? What am I trying to achieve? And it's also relevant that, you know, there's a lot of things that seem like goals that aren't goals that unsuccessful people do. So, for instance, there is such a thing as wishing. So if you sit around and say, yeah, I want to be a millionaire, but you don't come up with a plan, you don't ever take action, you don't even study, like, what's involved in becoming a millionaire. Or maybe if you do study, you just study, like, get-rich-quick schemes. That's really a wish or a self-delusion. It's not a goal. That in setting a goal, what we see successful people doing is setting a goal that is achievable, that is something that they can see by certain steps. Yeah, I could get from where I am to where I want to be. They have some plan of action that really gives reality to what they want to do. I think, for instance, of the story of Ayn Rand, just one element of her biography that I thought was really interesting, you know, she came to America, and her goal from a very young age, I think it was 8 or 9, maybe 10, was that she wanted to be a novelist. And she came to America, and she knew, look, I'm not ready to write novels yet, in part because I barely speak English. But she did decide, oh, you know what I can do? I can write for the silent screen. I can write story treatments. And so it's that she came up with this goal. I'm going to be a novelist first. How? By learning the craft and by supporting myself through writing for the silent screen. And so that's really the kind of thinking that's involved in setting goals, that are going to then direct you and guide you, set your course as you pursue success. And I think that leads obviously into the next point, which is success requires effort. If we look at the people who we regard as successful, the people who achieve a productive career that contributes to a happy life, these are people who exert effort. They work. And this is, I mean, it has two aspects. So first is they do the mental work involved. Learning. That anybody who's successful, you see them are constant learners. They're learning from books. They're learning from other people. They're learning from experience, and especially they're learning from their failures. I mean, one of my favorite learning stories is actually from Andrew Carnegie. He, he came to America as a 12-year-old immigrant, goes right to work. He had only been educated, I think, up to 12 years old. And, you know, he starts out in a loom factory for something like $1.20 a week. And quickly, I mean, he's working really hard, works his way up. And ends up working at a railroad company, I think, or a telegraph company. I forget the order here. But basically, there's a telegraph involved, and he's working these 10 or 12-hour shifts, and he starts coming in early to learn, just on his own time, how to read Morse code. And he actually becomes so good, he becomes one of only two people in the country at the time who can just listen to Morse code and just tell you what it's saying, not have to work it out with pen and paper. And so this really sets him off to success, but it's that effortful learning that you see successful people do again and again. We're in the midst of the presidential elections. Now, Ben Carson, I am not a fan of his religion. I'm not a fan of his politics, but he was an incredibly successful surgeon. And if you read the story of his life, there's a book called, Gifted Hands. It's a really great book. And the one period that really stuck out at me was, you know, he's going to medical school. And this is a guy from, you know, poor background, uneducated family. He is really trying to make it medical school. And he was struggling. He was not the smartest, best student by nature, but he would wake up every morning and basically sit and study his books over and over and over again until nightfall. So that's the learning side of effort. But then there's also just the actual physical actions, the actual producing, working hard. Now, this is, Ben Carson is another example here. In the book, I remember him talking about, so like once he's actually doing, I think, his internship, he's basically taking any shift he can get, any opportunity to work that he can find, including like covering for other people. And they're like, hey, all right, I'll go catch up on a nap. And Ben's like, great, an opportunity for me to learn, to get to do something that I wouldn't have otherwise. So it's that exerting the effort to show up and to really go above and beyond. The final big category I would put is they're not stopped by obstacles. So if we're talking about the patterns of successful people, they're setting goals, they're exerting effort, and when they run into roadblocks, they keep going. They don't, for instance, make excuses. These are people who take responsibility. And I mean, you see this in Atlas Shrugged quite a bit, that again and again, one of the things that Dagny Taggart, the hero, the heroine of the book, is doing is she's surrounded by people who have excuses and refuse to take responsibility, and she's always accepting it. She's accepting it because she's going to be a person of action. She's going to get things done. She's not going to let obstacles stop her. And when you make excuses, what you're really doing is stopping yourself. You're saying, I don't need to try to overcome these obstacles because it's not my fault. Well, if that's the choice you make, where are you going to end up? Another aspect of not being stopped by obstacles is self-discipline. And this is really important for long-range goals. Any long-range goal comes from a lot of short-range, day-by-day consistency of action. So obviously, I'm a writer. And basically, it's surprising. If everybody who wanted to write a book wrote a book, I think, like, first of all, we would have run out of trees very long ago. And who knows? We might have even run out of computer space. I mean, everybody, quote, wants to write a book. Well, what stops them? I think what stops them is that you can't write a book. You can only write a sentence, and then a paragraph, and then a page, and then a chapter, and then a draft that you have to edit over and over and over and over again. But it really comes from doing consistent work every day. And I think that's true in any pursuit of success, that it's the self-discipline to come back and keep chipping away at something, even when it's hard, even when it's unpleasant, even when you would love to do anything else on this earth. Tenacity. I mean, this is basically the kind of just never give up attitude. And I mean, you see this all the time in biographies of successful people. And I mean, Ayn Rand herself, you know, her first book, We the Living, is published and it is not successful. I think in large part that her publisher did not do a good job. And when the book did start catching on by word of mouth, it was too bad because they had destroyed the plate, so they couldn't reprint new copies. But nevertheless, she faced that failure, writes The Fountainhead, which would ultimately go on to become a classic. But first, it was rejected by something like 12 publishers. And yet, she had the tenacity to keep going. Henry Ford, before he launches the successful Model T, I think it was two or three car companies he started, failed. And yet these people, they succeed by not stopping. Finally, I would say another element of not being stopped by obstacles that you see over and over again is resourcefulness. That is, when they encounter an obstacle, they don't just say, okay, what are the obvious things to do and then do those. They're constantly searching out non-obvious ways to achieve their goals. I don't think I ever published this. But and I can't remember why, but a few years ago when I was first starting my podcast, I interviewed a girl who had actually appeared on the Shark Tank, the entrepreneurial show. And her story was that she had this talent for making these really stylish baby moccasins. And she actually sent some, and my daughter just wore them and wore them and wore them until she was too big for them. They're pretty amazing. The problem, and so she wanted to turn that talent into a money, but into a career, but she didn't have any money to get started. And so, what did she do? Did she go to the bank and take out a loan? No. What she actually did is her brother had a window business, and she basically asked him, "Hey, can I follow you around for the summer and keep the, you know, discarded windows?" So she goes around with him for a summer, knocks the glass out of these, you know, old windows, takes the aluminum at the end of the summer, turns it in for $200. The scrap aluminum gets her $200, and that's what she uses to launch the successful baby moccasin company. And that's the kind of resourcefulness you see. So those are the kinds of patterns that you see with success. And notice this. Are those a matter of luck? No, those are all a matter of choice. It's really challenging when you think of it, to try to think of circumstances that would prevent success in the form we've been talking about. Not success if, you know, we're talking about making millions of dollars and becoming president, but in terms of doing fulfilling self-supporting work, it's hard to come up with a scenario where if you actually choose to set goals, to exert effort, and to overcome obstacles, that you're not going to be able to achieve it. Certainly, there you can imagine some things happening, illness, accident, you know, really widespread injustice, like whether it's slavery or even, you know, Jim Crow, let's say, or the economy just tanks into a complete depression and nobody works. I mean, there's extreme scenarios you can paint, but as a rule, like, it is very hard to project a person who really embodies these chosen characteristics and is not able to achieve the kind of career that properly counts as successful. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to wrap up the discussion of success, and then we're going to be talking about some of the really interesting things that ARI is up to, and that I'm up to, and that Yoram Brook and I will be up to together as we launch Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. Stay tuned.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Rourke, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Rourke, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
We're back on the Yaron Brook Show. This is Dom Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. So I just have to thank Mark Pellegrino, who read that last commercial. And he also did the voiceover for our book trailer, which you can find on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and type in Equal is Unfair unofficial trailer, or not unofficial, the totally official trailer. And I think it turned out pretty cool. And Mark gave us a really, really nice quote for the book. I won't bother reading it, but if you go to Amazon, you can find it. And so we want to thank him for that. So I want to wrap up our discussion about success, and then we're going to turn to some of the exciting stuff that ARI is doing right now, including where I will be on the day that this airs at a really exciting event in Seattle. So we've been talking about success, and we talked about some of the what it means and the way in which there are certain patterns of choices that really lead to success. Now, there's obviously things outside of our control, and in particular, there's political barriers that I think, and other kinds of barriers from other people that can make it much harder to succeed. But I think the worst thing that you can do is precisely what the inequality critics have done, which is basically try to convince people that success is impossible. And, you know, what they'll usually do whenever somebody says, hey, guess what, you can achieve it if you make certain choices, is they'll say, well, what you're really doing is blaming the victim. You're blaming people for their failure. And I think this is so beside the point. I think you do have to view your success as your responsibility. And it may not be your fault that you haven't succeeded in a given time. If somebody's been, you know, the victim of discrimination or legal barriers to success or government policies that are driving down wages or something like that, well, it's not their fault that they haven't achieved what they want to achieve, but achieving success is still their responsibility. But responsibility here isn't about blame at all. It's about empowerment. And yet the inequality critics are trying to strip people of that because they're stripping away the role of choice in life and saying your choice doesn't matter. It's all a matter of luck. The bottom line here is that, no, you can't achieve anything, but you can achieve success if you think about it the right way and think about the principles necessary to do it. The egalitarians are wrong. So let's turn to something I think way more exciting and fun than the, you know, evil creed of the egalitarians. I'm here with my colleague, Keith Lockich. Keith, what's your new title?
Yes, I've recently become ARI's Vice President of Educational Programs.
Congratulations. Yeah, so Keith and I, and also Yaron Brook and Alon Giorno, as well as Andrew Lehman, who's a friend of the Institute, are all in Seattle today, the day this airs. And we're actually going to be speaking at a little session we put together called Building a Future of Reason and Capitalism. And Keith, why don't you tell people just a little bit about what we're doing here and kind of what the goal of the day is going to be.
So the goal of the day is to reach out to people who are interested in the Institute, interested in what we do, and to give them a flavor of the range of things that we work on. So Ilan is going to be talking about some of his work on the book that he's currently writing and the thinking that goes into that and what he's trying to accomplish in writing that book. You'll be there. You could tell us more about what you're going to say, but you know, I imagine you're going to be talking about your book and your goals in writing the Equal is Unfair and what you're trying to accomplish with that and how you're trying to get people to think differently about the debate. My topic is actually a little bit different because of my new role as Vice President of Educational Programs. I have the responsibility, I'm overseeing basically all of ARI's programs. And what I'm really excited to tell people about is what is ARI's strategy for reaching young minds, for getting them their first exposure to Ayn Rand, and then for getting them to engage with objectivism, to engage with Ayn Rand's ideas, and getting them to engage with a growing and vibrant objectivist movement. So we have a whole range of programs that all fit into an integrated strategy that's devoted to this goal of reaching young minds and getting them to engage with the philosophy and with the movement. And that's what I'm going to be talking about.
You know, I don't think anybody will catch this before they actually reach the event. Do you want to give anybody just a sneak preview? Because I'm really excited to hear your talk in particular. You know, you're talking about the way in which we have a strategy for taking people from that first encounter to the last. But both of us have experienced that firsthand. I know my story. But I think your idea is to give a little bit of yours.
Yeah. So if people have followed ARI's activities over the years, you know, we've given different versions of talks where we explain what our programs are. What I hope to do is to personalize it a little bit. There are all kinds of people out there who've been impacted by ARI's programs. And certainly everyone who works at the Institute has had various touch points with ARI over the years. And what I'm going to do is tell a little bit of my story, and not just for the sake of talking about myself, but because I think it's illustrative of how it is that the various programs can have an influence on a person's life. So just to give you an example, you know, I was introduced to Ayn Rand by my parents. So that's, you know, I read her novels and had my first exposure that way. But then one of the very first things I did was I was walking down a hallway in my high school. This is in probably 1986.
And, I will not say how old I was.
Yeah. And I looked on a bulletin board and I saw a flyer advertising an essay contest on the Fountainhead. And this was a huge coincidence for me because I had just read the book. I loved the book. I was blown away by the book. And I thought, wow, how cool is that, that there's an organization called the Ayn Rand Institute, you know, and they're offering a scholarship, an essay contest, where you can win cash prizes for writing an essay on the book. So I entered the essay contest in 1987.
Did you win?
I would love to be able to say that I won the contest, but unfortunately I did not. But, you know, I got a very nice letter from Michael Berliner, who was the executive director at the time, letting me know that I didn't win. It was very friendly.
Well, but it's actually a good thing, because I run into kids who get frustrated and they think, you know, oh, I didn't, you know, I never win. I said, I never placed. And, you know, I eventually wrote for the Institute. So it's possible to overcome that.
Yeah. So I entered the essay contest in 1987. And, you know, that was very important for me. It wasn't just a matter of reading the books, but it was an opportunity to dig deeper into the ideas. This prompted me to go out and look for some of Ayn Rand's nonfiction works in the bookstore. This was in the late 80s when they still had bookstores, you know. So this was important for me in giving me an incentive and an opportunity to dig deeper into the ideas. You know, at the time, I also noticed that the copy of Atlas Shrugged that I had a little insert card that you could, you know, perforated insert card that you could rip off and you could mail it in, and then you'd start getting things in the mail. So I did that.
For the younger folks, can you explain what mail is?
Well, yes, you get a stamp and you write your address on it.
Oh, this is
snail mail.
Way too hard.
Well, but the interesting thing is, I mean, there is a parallel to today, because by sending that card in effect, what that meant was that I had opted in to receive, you know, snail mail communications from whatever organizations were connected with that, with the group that I sent it into. And so in the same way that today, you know, you can opt in to receive communications by email and so on, I used to get a steady stream of ads in the mail. There were organizations that had a mail order catalog where you could order cassette tapes of audio lectures, you know, by Ayn Rand and other people.
Those were some of the best and worst memories of my teenage years. I remember I would have my windows open so I could see the mailbox and constantly look to see, did my new tape course get delivered? And if it didn't, I had to wait 24 hours. Or if it was a Saturday, I'd have to wait 48 to...
24 hours, I mean, you know, they used to deliver by stagecoach and carrier pigeon. No, I'm just kidding. But, the pace of things was very different. You'd send it in by mail and you'd wait for stuff to come in. But, you know, so there was a mail order catalog where you could order audio lectures. You could rent out Leonard Peikoff's lecture courses and play them for groups of people. There was a newsletter that you could subscribe to. I got information about the Ayn Rand Institute. One of the most important pieces of information that I got in the mail was a brochure for the summer conference. Now, that was very important for me because I, after spending a couple of years reading more of Ayn Rand's nonfiction, subscribing to the newsletter, you know, listening to the audio lectures and so on, I decided that I wanted to get an experience of what this movement was really about. So in 1990, I went to my first Objectivist conference, and that was a life-changing experience for me. If anybody is listening to this show right now... If anybody is listening to the show and you haven't registered for this summer's OCON, go to objectivistconferences.com, take a look at what's there, sign up right away. It's going to be a really exciting conference this summer. And, you know, it's hard to describe what the experience is like of actually being at the conference. For me in 1990, you know, I was learning more about the ideas, but actually going to the conference and meeting other young people who are just as excited about these ideas as I was, you know, having the opportunity to be in the lecture hall when people who I really admired were giving lectures on the ideas. You know, I could go up and ask questions, and they were forever immortalized on the audio cassette tapes that, you know, I was listening to. So it's a really, I mean, to this day, we get feedback from students who attend our conference who tell us that this is just a life-changing, world-changing experience for them. And you know, you get an experience not just of the ideas, but of what this movement is that's formed around objectivism, and you know, the exciting vision of the future that one can work towards. The vision that Ayn Rand had for the kind of society that we can create if people understand and accept these ideas, this is the kind of world that you experience when you go to the conference.
Two scenarios, though. I picture the person out there who's saying, but I don't know anybody. It seems kind of scary to go to a whole conference where I know no one. What's your answer to that kind of concern? Because I actually think that's the best person to go to the conference, not the person who shouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, give it a shot. What have you got to lose? I went to the conference basically by myself, and, you know, it was a little scary. In fact, I think I hadn't really done a lot of traveling at that time. You know, I was pretty young. I just started college. But people are very friendly. You know, they're eager to meet young people who are interested in Ayn Rand's ideas. The students at the conference are a great group. You know, they always have a lot of fun. I'm getting a little old to be able to stay up till 2 a.m. with them talking philosophy at the bar, but... you know, that's the mood at the conference. It's fun. There's a lot of energy. There's a lot of really interesting, nice people who are interested in these ideas, and you'll have a blast.
Yeah, and we do a lot of stuff now, I think particularly or specifically aimed at taking new people and getting, like, you know, I don't know if we're going to do it again this year, but in the past we've had a welcoming dinner.
Yeah, first-timers reception.
Yeah, so I definitely think that, you know, that cannot be your excuse not to go. Now, you mentioned students. I think they always get the most out of it by far. And but I'm a student. I don't have any money. What am I going to do?
Well, we can solve that problem because we have student scholarships available.
All right.
So go to objectivistconferences.com. If you click on the student link, you'll see the steps that you have to go through. I think we want people to register for the conference first. The student registration is a fraction of the full cost of the conference, so that shouldn't be too much of a deterrent. And then you can apply for a scholarship. You know, we have a whole bunch of scholarships available. If you apply now, you're very likely to get a scholarship. We have special programming for students. You know, if you're worried about the kind of concern you were mentioning earlier, we have the day before the conference starts, we're going to have a welcome and orientation session for students, and there's a student-only reception. So the day before the conference even starts, on Friday, July 1st, you'll have an opportunity to meet just the other students who were there on scholarship and to meet some of the faculty, meet some of ARI's staff intellectuals, and kind of ease into the conference that way.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to be giving a talk and sitting on a panel. A lot of really great speakers, a lot of really great attendees. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to this Seattle event. As Keith mentioned, I'm going to be talking about Equal is Unfair. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about the kind of goal of the book, why I think it's important, why I think ARI and Ayn Rand's perspective is so critical to this issue. Because, you know, it's notable that nobody else has written a book challenging the inequality critics. Well, there's a partial exception. Thomas Sowell has a book where he says they get a lot of their statistics wrong. And that's useful as far as it goes. But this is really a philosophically driven campaign. And if you can't challenge it at a philosophical level, you cannot win the debate. So I'm very eager to delve into that and explain it. And if you want one of these in your town, these are still kind of we did a similar kind of event in New York at our last fundraising dinner. This is kind of an experiment in a certain way, but it's shaping up to be really, really successful. If this is something that you might be interested in getting to come to your town, I definitely encourage you contact us. You can contact Lynn Zinser at the Institute, lzinser@aynrand.org, and let us know if you think you can get 100 people to attend. It's something that we definitely like to talk to you about doing. There's been a lot of other stuff, you know, going on. We'll be announcing a ton of events and so on. I've been traveling already around the country to CPAC, which is the big conservative conference promoting the book, and Yaron has been all over the place. And I want to tell you about a couple of upcoming events that you can make, if I can actually find the list. So let's see. For you guys who are local in Orange County, by the way, I'm going to be speaking actually tomorrow from the time you hear this. That's Sunday, March 10th, on the importance of Ayn Rand's ideas where am I speaking? Well, it's in Orange County. It's for the Humanist Club. I'm sorry. The list I'm looking at is actually inaccurate, and so that will have to change. But we have a couple of really exciting things that Yaron's going to be doing coming up. And let's see. Where is the one that I'm particularly excited to tell you about? So he's going to be in debating inequality for Chicago Ideas Week. Do we have the information for that? All right, so the 21st in Chicago, he's going to be debating actually somebody he's debated before, but I think is a really great debating partner. This is James Galbraith. James Galbraith is one of the leading, a leading economist and a leading critic of economic inequality. And you can find more details about that one and actually all of these events on our website, ari.aynrand.org/events. And so there'll be a lot going on in Chicago in later March. Both Yaron and I are going to be in New York right around the launch of the book. And in particular, what I want to encourage anybody in the New York area to do is come to our event on the day of the launch. So that is March 29th. We're going to be hosting an event at CUNY. Is that how you pronounce it? CUNY? CUNY? The City University. Thank you, Keith. And we'll be there. We'll be joined by C-SPAN's Book TV. And so, you know, if you want your 15 minutes of fame, this is your chance. So please join us again. We'll have more information on that coming up. But the best place is to go to our website and look up under events. Let's see. So that's the main stuff that is going to be going on.
Can I just say something about that?
Yeah, please.
So, you know, one thing that we're going to be talking about at the conference is the Objectivist community and ways that people can become more engaged. So I would encourage any of you who are listening to this, don't just come out to the event. You know, pick up the book, read the book, think about the book, and come out and you know, Don and Yaron will be happy to talk to you, engage with you, bring your friends. You know, the whole idea is to get people not just passively sort of observing the content, but really consuming it and becoming a part of it and becoming a part of the movement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, otherwise you might as well just drive for half an hour and then watch a YouTube video. Get the most out of it. And I really love meeting various people. It's always interesting to hear how people got interested in Ayn Rand, what their questions are, what their objections are, to have them really grapple with our work and for us to be able to grapple with their questions. And it does help build those networks. So, I mean, I think there's so much opportunity to enrich the Objectivist community. I mean, that's certainly one of the goals at ARI. And one of the ways that happens is more people need to meet people, more people need to be interacting. And I think these events are a really great way to do it. And they're predominantly, not all of them, not the Seattle event and not OCOM, but they're predominantly free and open to the public. And so there's, I think, just so many opportunities to do this sort of thing. And so, you know, you can set your bookmarks to our events page and just keep updated, because there's just a endless stream of things coming down. I don't think we're going to see Yaron again for about 4 or 5 years at least, based on what I've seen coming up.
At the office.
Yeah, at the office. Yeah, we'll see him on YouTube and TV, and maybe at OCON, right? But yeah, and so in the meantime, I hope you can help us support the book Equal is Unfair. When we were at CPAC, obviously the book's not out yet, but my colleague Mikey and I went around wearing our Equal is Unfair t-shirts. And what was amazing is at the conference, it's not that big a surprise that a bunch of conservatives see it and go, wow, what's that? That's awesome. But it happened with like hotel employees or just people in the street. Like, it is a concept that automatically resonates with a lot of people, but at least evokes curiosity. And so if you actually want to, you know, start those conversations and help us get the word of mouth out, now we're going to figure out how to actually get the t-shirts in your hands, but you know, get them on yourself or your college student, and we can help create that kind of word of mouth buzz. And I mean, I think they just look pretty cool, frankly. So yeah, it is a good title. Although, if people don't know you're talking about economic inequality, it can lead to some uncomfortable moments before you clarify. You know, I'm not trying to erase political equality or something like that. But that's part of the why, you know, it's provocative.
That's the conversation you want to have.
Yeah, exactly. Is to get that there is this distinction, that it's blended by the people who want to make it plausible that we should equalize economically, and they're cashing in on the fact that we should be treated equally as individuals with rights by the government. So, yeah, check out, make sure you pre-order the book. You can bulk order. There's information for that on the website, and you know, we'll try to figure out how everybody can get their hands on a t-shirt. But with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of the Yaron Brooks Show. We will be back next week. I don't know if Yaron will be here, but hopefully he will. And as always, feel free to send your feedback, promote us on Twitter, promote us on social media, and let us know what you think. Until next time. 4-1.